Okay, so I was asked to talk about, well, I don't know what I was asked to talk about, but what I'm going to talk about is, you know, the standard supernova engine that we currently believe works, and most of the large groups are working on this engine, and why we believe it's right. So why we actually trust ourselves. And I'm going to go back, I think I need to start a little bit with some history, and then I'll get into the engine and then talk about, I hope to go through and say how we evolved this model since the 1930s onto where we are now. I will say, even though we have all the evidence keeps on growing, we seem to believe it more and more. We get more and more detailed models. That does not mean it's the right engine. It just means this is what we believe it to be. So let's start with the history. So supernova, the idea, the term supernova, was actually first put forth by Bada and Zwicky, and they actually, when they wrote it, they actually had a hyphen. So they actually, their papers were all supernova. And so Bada and Zwicky proposed this for a class of nova that had been observed that were more bright than others. So they were super bright, supernova. So they proposed this in this name. It's the first time I saw it is in a paper they did in 1934. They had a whole series of papers in 1934. At the same time, so in 1928, I can't even pronounce her name, Joliot Curie, the daughter of Marie Curie, and her husband were studying the neutron along with people like Chadwick, and they had started to understand what a neutron was. They were classifying this neutron. In the early 1930, 1932, papers started coming out describing what a neutron is. In 1934, these guys, to explain this supernova, they actually argued that maybe it's coming from the collapse of a neutron a star down to a neutron star. So they had the concept of saying, I'm going to take this core, and we know what neutrons are. Let's imagine a star made all of neutrons. And so they said, okay, can we get the energy? And that's pretty easy to calculate. You just have something that mass of that core of the star times divided by the radius of the neutron star. So I'm just looking at the potential energy, and I can calculate. So this was what the radius of the core was. I just calculate what the energy was released, right? So I could either, I've already done the minus sign so that I can get this into a positive number. So this is what you'd get if you... What did they use for RNS? Oh, so they didn't have it back then. They just knew it had to be, it was going to be pretty compact. So they didn't have a good equation to say, now we know, well, we know as well as we know anything in nuclear physics, that this radius is around between, if I'm really generous, between 8 to 15. I don't think anybody would say it's not in that range of 8 to 15 kilometers. I always use 10. So
they knew it was going to be aborted the density of atomic nucleus.
Yeah, so they had a rough idea. They had a rough idea. If you plug into this and you take, you know, a solar mass or so, you're going to get a few times 10 to the 53 ergs. So they have they realized in 1934 they could get an energy that was 10 to the 53 ergs. That was more than enough to explain the supernova that they were observing, the energetics they were seeing. Now they didn't have a really firm number on this, but this was the results that they were getting. But they didn't do any simulations. They just said, okay, what can we, you know, what's something that might provide the numbers? With time, they realized it wasn't that much later that Gamow actually argued that you would see neutrinos from these. So that these would emit a lot of neutrinos as they collapse down. So a lot of the basic concepts, I have neutrinos coming in from this core, I'm collapsing down in a neutron star, happened in the 30s and the early 40s. So we actually knew that concept early on. In the end, we know that the energy we actually need to explain most supernova is only about 1% of this. So somehow, anybody should be able to be 1% efficient at anything they do in life. That's all we theorists needed was 1% efficiency. So at the time, they didn't have enough about nuclear burning to actually propose the 1/8. That happened with Fowler and Hoyle. At least the earliest paper I could find pushing that was Fowler and Hoyle in 1960.
Bodies of Wilkie supernovas were actually 1A.
Oh, in fact, the one that they were trying to explain, I think, was a 1A.
Oh, yeah. Really?
So it was, they had the core collapse model, but they had the wrong supernova. Yeah. This is their model. The alternative model is the thermonuclear supernova, where you're going to take carbon and oxygen, fuse it, turn it into iron in a core. That releases a lot of thermonuclear energy. You can drive an explosion. I'm not going to talk about those at all today. So I'm just going to talk about this.
How did they know it was anomalously luminous?
This is when they just got the distances.
Yeah. So they had this. Yeah, that's right. So they had rough distances. They said, okay, this one's.
But then they said that Tycho was probably so it was the galactic.
What happened between the 1930s and the 1960s is they got a lot more data on this. And then in the 1960s, astronomers said, okay, we're going to try and simulate this. We just have to be 1% efficient. Anybody can do that. And we're going to do this. So the first effort was by Colgate and Johnson.
The same Colgate which was in California?
Yeah. And at the time, he was at Livermore. And they were working on numerical codes in Livermore. And he said, okay, I'm just going to make this explode. I'm going to take this core. They had a toy version of the equation of state. So something that essentially when you got to about nuclear densities, I'm going to make it really stiff. So what they did is they took an equation of state. They built up a core. They slightly lowered the energy in the equation of state. So it was originally supported by thermal pressure. They slightly reduced that, and they let it collapse. And then they said, okay, we're going to see what happens when it collapses. Now, they knew what really is happening is you're building up this iron core. It's supported by electron degeneracy pressure. It's supported by thermal pressure. And if you get it dense enough, it will start to capture the electrons onto the protons. That will remove that electron degeneracy pressure. It starts to contract. That causes it to contract, accelerate its electron capture, and pretty soon you have a runaway collapse, and you get this runaway collapse, and you collapse down to a neutron star. What they did is they just artificially put that into their codes, let that happen, and then they had an equation of state that once it got to some point near nuclear densities, they're going to make a hard pressure coming from both nuclear forces and neutron degeneracy pressure, and watch that bounce. So that's what they did. They watched this star collapse, it bounced, and it sent a little bit of material out. If you ever see a lecture by Alex Filipenko, he will bring it back. And so I was going to bring it, but it's not really the engine, so I'm not going to do it. He brings a basketball and a tennis ball and shows you how you can take that potential energy from the basketball and shoot the tennis ball out. And there's even a toy you used to be able to buy that had a little description by Sterling Colgate on the back where you have a series of balls and you really send the top ball going fast. In fact, that kind of...
I hurt myself with that.
So they had this model. It seemed to work, except people started adding physics, and that's it's always a bad thing. So if I only need 1% efficiency, it's great. If I don't look too deep, but they started adding physics. And one of the things they said, there's a couple effects that weren't included. One is, yes, this thing bounces and it sends out a shock, but most of the energy is in neutrinos. It's so hot that it's radiating neutrinos, but since it's so dense, the neutrinos are then interacting with matter and they're trapped in that flow. Well, that shock starts to move out and it gets out to about 100 kilometers and the neutrinos are no longer trapped and they start to leak out. And suddenly that shock, its energy, all goes away and it stalls. There's another physics effect, and that is the shock's moving out and as it moves out and hits material, it's dissociating all of that material, the whatever it is. So if an iron atom, it dissociates it down to alpha particles. That takes energy. We got energy in the star by burning everything from alpha particles to iron. At the very end of its life, we just throw that away and we take that material and put it back into alphas. So you lose that energy again. And so the shock stalled. And that gave us a problem because we had something like a protoneutron star, that had just formed. It had sent out a bounce shock moving through the star, and then that bounce shock stalled. And so now I have a situation where the stars realize now that the material below it has its rug has been pulled out from under it, and it's falling in. So it's falling in on this stalled shock region, and now I have to somehow turn that star around. If I don't turn around, this material will fall in. It'll accrete onto the protoneutron star until the neutron star gets above what neutron degeneracy pressure and nuclear forces can support, and it'll go down to a black hole. So if I can't turn this around, I'm in trouble. And so this is where Colgate and White, and this is the paper people usually cite, did the following thing and proposed the neutrino-driven mechanism, which is they said, okay, that's true, but I still have this hot protoneutron star. It's still emitting a lot of neutrinos. They're leaking out of the protoneutron star, and I'm going to have these neutrinos reheat this stalled shock region to drive an explosion. So, and they could do it because they said, okay, I'm going to take a couple percent of that neutrino energy and plop it into this region and let it explode. And it works. So if I only need it, all I have to do is say, well, everything is a couple percent efficient. No one can be not that. I get an explosion, and we're done. And so that's where we were in the 1960s. And then what happened was people added physics. And they started to do the neutrino transport correctly. And what happened there was once you got that, it became much harder to get the neutrinos to be efficient enough at depositing energy to drive an explosion. And the issue is, the neutrinos are coming out here, so that's these orange. I wanted to make Natasha happy, which I realize that's almost... I won't go anywhere. but yeah, I use the color. So my orange neutrinos are coming out. Where they deposit their energy is just above the protoneutron star. Neutrinos don't interact that much. I almost bought it. There's a nice poem on neutrinos. The point is they don't actually interact very well. So most of their interaction is just above the neutrino sphere. So I have, it's just right where I have, I can deposit a lot of energy. And I start depositing just beyond the protoneutron star. So we call this the gain region. We have a region where neutrinos are actually depositing energy. If I'm doing a one-dimensional calculation, the problem is that energy gets deposited there. It heats up that material. It starts to push out, so it's trying to push out down here. It's trying to push out. It gets hotter and hotter until it starts emitting neutrinos too. And so the engine didn't work because it would heat up this material until it started emitting neutrinos. And the heating was not enough. Before the neutrinos started getting emitted, that was not enough heat to make it drive it out. You need more energy than what you could get from just that neutrino heating. You needed to get that energy in, but not have the neutrino emission. So you have these problems. How do I get that energy in, but not have the neutrinos lose it all again by emitting the in neutrinos again? And so that's where we were. The last bit of history was, funnily enough, people kept on adding, doing better calculations, adding physics. One of the ideas people had, and Richard Epstein did this in 1979, so I'll write down him as well. And because I'll come back to this, but he said, okay, we need to get the neutrinos out quicker. Maybe that will help. So he argued I do some protoneutron star convection, and I'm going to talk about this in a little bit more detail if you guys want it. He argued that there would be protoneutron star convection that would allow neutrinos from in here to come out here quicker. If I could really deposit the neutrinos really quickly, even though this gain region starts to emit neutrinos, if I'm depositing faster than it can emit for a brief time, maybe that can make it explode. And that was one of the ideas. So people were looking at these kinds of ideas. How do they make the neutrinos more efficient? How can we get this 1 to 2% efficiency and actually drive an explosion?
So how do you define protoneutron star here?
So usually you see a nice sharp, the density is at 10 to the 14, and you see a nice sharp density fall. And usually people say, okay, that's my protoneutron star. The neutrino sphere is just above that. And so it's, there's not a really hard definition for the where the protoneutron star is. Usually it's where that density takes a nice sharp drop. So if I looked at density in this profile, it would come out. Density is high, 10 to the 14, and does a nice drop like this, and then you have this convective region that's right down there. Yeah.
I was wondering if at this time there was simultaneous, like there was the realization that you would have failures and those would lead to black holes, and whether or not that was being connected to the sort of black hole work that was happening. I mean, that's not so sort of linear, but still, I'm just wondering whether or not people thought at this time, well, maybe you actually get black holes too.
I'm not, certainly I didn't, the papers I've read didn't have that discussion. I'm not sure, I'm sure they knew about it.
So it was just blow up or bust?
Well, the papers that I'm, on the supernova engine were all on, how do I make it blow up? I think they probably, cared.
I just wonder if at any point in this history people were like, you know, these fail a lot. Like maybe there's a lot of black holes around. Like,
so I didn't see that in the papers I've read. I haven't seen that kind of discussion of I just didn't read the papers that they had that discussion.
When the people have been saying about emitting neutrinos, so for those emitting neutrinos, their energy spectrum was completely well known, and again, like which neutrinos are captured, also again, it's just a fraction, or it's a specific energy of neutrinos which are.
Oh, how well do they know the neutrino physics, or what do you?
Yeah. So I mean, how well we knew which neutrinos are escaping and which are neutrinos are getting caught, and is it a fraction? Is it specific energy?
I mean, we. Are you asking for the history thing, or how do we know it now? So now we actually have pretty good ideas of, we put in the best physics for the neutrino cross-sections. We know the mu and tau cross-sections are pretty low. So, you know, if you ask where do the mu and tau neutrinos escape, they escape from deeper in the protoneutron star, but they don't interact much, so it's hard to get them to deposit energy. By 1987, we had detailed models for the neutrinos leaking out of a protoneutron star, the time dependence of those neutrinos. We even had rough, I wouldn't say spectra, but we had temperatures for those neutrinos. So we had average temperatures for those neutrinos. At that time, most of the calculations were done with gray neutrino transport. But they did, and they were doing, at best, fluxion and diffusion, that kind of transport. Let's see. I think the first higher order transport in 1D would have been someone like Metzakappa, and I think he was a little later than 1987. I don't know, so this would be me not knowing his age.
So when in 1987 they captured several neutrinos from supernova 87, they have been completely as expected, or we've been kind of out of it?
So let's talk about 1987A. So this is what kind of changed the picture was the supernova 1987A. It went off in the Large Magellanic Clouds. If you haven't seen Bob Kirshner give a talk recently on this, he's starting to wax a lot and show nice videos of what they were doing back in that period. So 1987A went off. It was the first naked eye supernovas for something like 300 years. It was nearby. They went and told the neutrino guys, and as Bob Kirshner tells it, the neutrino guys, the IMB guys, were on vacation skiing somewhere. The Japanese were also out, but they apparently work on the weekend if called in, and they went and saw it in their data first. But then the IMB guys came back and they also saw the bucks. There's a Russian detection as well. It was timed maybe 10 hours off from everybody else. At this point, no one believes that result. They had echo arguments and stuff to try to explain it. I don't think there's very many people believing it. I think it's just those two, the Japanese and the IMB result. They got 17 neutrinos. And they had some information on the energy of the neutrinos, the time emission of the neutrinos. People had made predictions of what should the neutrino, how putting in their best nuclear physics, when should the neutrinos come out? The bulk of them come out in a very short period, but they keep on leaking out to 20 seconds. The results from the neutrinos seem to match that. So we had something that said, this is core collapse. There's almost no other way to make that kind of neutrino signal except for something going down to a neutron star being really hot. And so it did. It was probably the best validation for at least this first part of the engine that it is a collapse down to a neutron star. So we can't get it to explode yet, but we have shown that it's, you know, this collapse engine, this idea of Bade and Zwicky did work. You know, it is happening. Now we just have to figure out how to make it work. There were some other interesting results from 87A. First of all, it was a blue, not red, supergiant, which got people re-looking at their stellar models. But it was a star. So they saw it. The story on this is Bob Kirshner, they had a couple candidates. There was apparently some confusion of which star was it. So they had been observing the Large Magellanic Cloud, so they had an observation prior to the collapse. They went back and looked at it. Bob apparently got the wrong star initially. When they finally figured out which star it was, which apparently, as Bob would put it, in the end, it's pretty easy to decide because this star that's gone. They got the star. It was a blue supergiant, not a red supergiant, but something that did tell us, okay, this kind of house of cards that we had where it's the collapse of a massive star down to a neutron star between it and the neutrinos really did. There's a nice video of Sterling Colgate being interviewed. Willie Fowler's next to him, and he's going, we had this house of cards that none of us believed. You know, we just had it. We were working on it. That's what we thought from theory. And then we got this validation. It really did validate the model that core collapse is part of it. But we still don't know what the engine is. We just know that it has to have something to it. There were some other observations that started to provide those clues. And one of them was, so immediately, Phil Pinto was a grad student with Stan Woosley at that time. They immediately decided, we'll do a calculation and decide when you should look for the gamma rays from this supernova.
How long before the explosion was the image taken, the latest image?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think it wasn't that long before. I mean, I think it was months, but not
years. Months, okay.
But I could be completely wrong.
I think there was an observation from the day before.
The star? They got the star, luckily. They just had an observation the day before of the Magellanic Cloud.
Well, they had been taking images of the Magellanic Cloud for a couple nights in a row. I don't know if they were high enough for, like, the progenitor star itself. The best images of the progenitor star were from before that. But there was an image of that region the day before which showed it hadn't exploded yet.
That's excellent. So Pinto and Woosley decided, okay, we'll help the observers. We'll tell the gamma ray observers when they should look for gamma rays from 87A. Now, the issue with the gamma rays is they're coming from nickel decay. Nickel is made in the inner ejecta, so you have to wait a little bit for that nickel to get uncovered so you can see the gamma rays. So they calculated it, and they did a model, and they said, okay, it's going to take 200, 250 days before you'll see any gamma rays from 87A. Funnily enough, and this is still true today, the observers rightfully ignored the theorist's predictions and looked at 150 days. And at 150 days, there was already a bright gamma ray signal. So somehow that nickel got uncovered faster than any of the models predicted. They took their best progenitors of 87A based on the light curve, and they put it in, and somehow the nickel got uncovered early.
But how we had the best progenitor before we calculated all four
red supergiants? So immediately, this was happening in 1980, it didn't take that long to run models. So once it was not they realized it was a blue and not a red, the first thing Stan Woolsey did is created some blue supergiants. So, the stellar modelers didn't take much more than, I mean, they were sleeping in their offices, and, you know, within 10 days, they had blue supergiant models. But it did not work. So they couldn't get what Pinto and Woolsey did is they mixed out the nickel. They said somehow it's going to get mixed out, and that's going to cause, get it out sooner. The other evidence they had was they looked at things like the iron lines and the how broad were the iron lines, and they were way broader than you'd expect if you didn't get mix them out somehow. If I can mix them out to the higher velocity regions, it will then have higher velocities, you get broader lines. So the next step that the theorists were working on is how do we explain these broad iron lines, the mixing out of the nickel? Can it just be, I have a symmetric explosion, it goes through a star, it's Rayleigh-Taylor unstable, can I get that nickel mixed out? So that was the goal of, in the early 90s, late 80s, the goals of a lot of supernova simulations, trying to understand how do we explain this mixing. So there was a group, there were several groups. Arnett did some simulations in 2D. There was even some 3D simulations down, in the late 80s, early 90s, trying to get this mixing. One of the big groups was still working with Sterling Colgate. It was Mark Arant, Willie Benz, Sterling Colgate, and they said, okay, let's do this and see what we can explain. They put in a lot of the physics that you need. They put in nickel decay, so the gamma rays from nickel decay, they got nickel. When the nickel decays, it deposits energy that puffs up that nickel region. So they were concluding all this physics. No matter what they did, if they had a spherical explosion, they didn't get enough mixing. So what they started thinking about is, somehow I have to have asymmetries in the explosion before it goes off. And so they started to put in, they started to say, where can those instabilities occur? And then how can I put in that asymmetry? So this was really, they started thinking about this engine by looking at how do we explain this data. So let's think about what you would do if you have this collapse. The question is, you can see I've already drawn in some convection. How does this convection occur? So I have this shock, it moves out and it stalls. So you can actually do simple derivations and say, okay, what is the pressure as this shock moves out? So I have something like the pressure of the shock is it's where I have the velocity of the shock. And really this velocity shouldn't be this shock. It's the velocity of the outward moving material plus the inward moving material. But I'm just going to call this the velocity of the shock anyway. So I have something for the pressure of the shock. I have something for the density of the shock. I'm just using the strong shock limit here. So I just have, I have estimates for both the pressure and the density of the shock. Because I kind of got trained in the beta school, this doesn't tell me much. But if I go to entropy, which in a radiation dominated case is just p to the 3/4 power over rho, and then I put that in here, I get something that looks like, I'm going to just put a proportional sign, rho to the minus 1/4 power V shock to the 3/2 power. So that's what the entropy looks like. The reason I like entropy is then if I can just get something where the entropy gradient is greater than zero, I have something that's unstable. So this was the initial idea that they had was what does the shock leave behind? And so there's some interesting things that you can see. It's unstable if it's negative. It's unstable. Let's see. Did I do it in the right? It's unstable. It depends on which direction you call the R. Yeah. So let's make it negative because that's the way that I will eventually do it. So I know this limit after I decide which direction I've made R. But if R is going outward, yeah, it has to be negative. Okay. So if you plugged in, if you said the density profile was going on down as R to the third power, and this shock velocity was just, if it was dominated by the infall velocity, it would go in as one the 1/2 power, and this would be constant, right? So if I said R is going as R to the minus 3, And V shock is dominated by the infall velocity. So it's dominated by V infall. This just goes as R to the minus 1/2. And I hit minus 3/4, sorry. 3/4 minus 3/4. Entropy is a constant. However, in a lot of our calculations, the shock velocity itself is playing a role, and the issue is as it moves out here and stalls, the velocity decreases dramatically. And if you look, depending on whose calculations you get, you'll get something where the entropy as a function of radius has, it looks kind of flat, but there'll be some dips. And if you plug in the, should be a dip and then flat again. If you plug in these, actually goes a dip and then it goes down. But this is where that, shock region is. But this is where the details of the calculation make a difference. But if I look at the calculations that I'm doing and I ask myself, I have something that's now unstable. I can do something like the Brunt-Weissheimer frequency and ask, what is the, growth time of this instability? It's usually on orders of a couple milliseconds. So I have something that should grow on the order of a couple milliseconds. We have different instabilities that can happen. If this instability, and I was just actually at a meeting with Roger Chevalier, who came up with this, if the entropy were completely flat, and so you didn't have any, the Rayleigh-Taylor wasn't strong, you could have the standing accretion shock instability. And I think, did Thierry already talk about this?
He talked about some related to accretion shock instability, but not so much more already, but some motions inside.
We have a number of instabilities that can occur here. The thing that also drives the Rayleigh-Taylor is, I can tell you right after the shock, there is some Rayleigh-Taylor that wants to develop at a very sharp, short time scale. There's also this problem that I'm heating on this bottom part, so that's adding entropy. So I have something that continues to drive that Rayleigh-Taylor. And so, at some level, depending on, the group that's studying it, they either get strong, they think the motions they're getting are strong Rayleigh-Taylor, or they have it being standing accretion shock instability. The problem is, in both cases, you get turbulence, and they're apparently, our understanding of standing accretion shock instability is not good enough that we can rule it out or rule it in for the model. Originally the predictions were its growth time were by Chevalier and Huck and Chevalier who first did it, and also Blondin, the growth time was long, above 100 milliseconds. If it is long and the Rayleigh-Taylor is short, Rayleigh-Taylor is going to dominate. But it's not clear to me that that's the case in detail, and that's where things have changed. Yeah.
Since you're using now the results of the simulations, if I understood that the features in the entropy you're talking about, they come from the numerical simulations, right?
Yeah.
So do we know that there is convergence in numerical scheme and resolution?
We don't, right? I had a paper in 2007 saying, look, the Rayleigh-Taylor growth time should be 2 milliseconds. It's taking my code 20 milliseconds to start growing. What am I doing wrong? Well, I know what I'm doing wrong. I'm not getting enough resolution down there. And in fact, there were lots of calculations that they had such coarse resolution that the Rayleigh-Taylor didn't grow. So in fact, you could check there was a paper by it was Doug Sesti and maybe Doug Sesti, I think, was the first author, where they did a really high resolution thing, and they said, oh my goodness, it does grow at 2 milliseconds. Which, we know this. We've known this from turbulence theory. You do these analyses, it will grow quickly. However, they couldn't follow the rest of it, so they stopped with, it goes at 2 milliseconds. So when we usually put in all the physics, we don't have enough resolution to really get this. That's one of the issues. The other issue is the growth depends a little bit, a lot, on the seeds that you have. So depending on how the initial models of core collapse, they would do it in 1D, do the bounce, and then start it going. And so whatever you put in your seed gives you your answer. There's people like Sean Couch studying silicon burning just before collapse so that he can put in those seeds. Dave Arnett also does this. We put in those seeds and start to study what are the initial perturbations that were going to grow with the Rayleigh-Taylor. The numerical simulations are far from doing a quantitative number. All I want to say is that we do know there should be growth. From analytics, we can say the growth should be fast. And that's an instability we should worry about. I want to come back a little bit to this stuff, the idea of Epstein in 1979. Let's see if I can remember. A student, Wolfgang Keil, working with Thomas Janka, studied this proto-neutron star convection, and it's an interesting different instability, which is the entropy profile here is, if anything, stable. So the entropy is actually increasing a little bit with as you go out in radius. But there is or it's flat, but there is, at the where the neutrinos start to leak out, the neutrinos de-leptonize that neutron star. So what's happening is you're getting electron capture, the electron neutrino escapes, and now that material is getting more and more neutron rich. So I have something that, I have it more neutron rich, neutrons heavy. Below it is something that is not neutron rich with electrons. Now it's a heavy material on top of a light material, and it wants to convect. And so there's a lot of discussion on, because the entropy was slightly stabilizing, it goes to the salt finger scenario where you have the hot Mediterranean Ocean going onto the Atlantic, flowing into the Atlantic. The Mediterranean Ocean is hotter, but it's saltier. And so it ends up developing instabilities, and it's a fight between how well do you diffuse the material versus how well do you conduct heat. And there's discussions there. But Kyle and Janka did a whole bunch of simulations of this, and what happens is you get it unstable, it allows the neutrinos to get moved out, and then it makes a bigger region that's de-leptonized, and so it can grow to a large fraction of the neutron star where you're actually getting neutrinos out, and that changes this neutrino flux. So that's another piece of physics that we have to include. But you know, so you have convection in here, and you also have convection out here. But the kind of thing that we're focusing, most theorists are focusing right now, are on this convection. We have several instabilities that might occur. We simulate it. The simulations aren't perfect, but we can start to make some predictions on what we should get out of the observations. So let's go back to the energy. The first thing we needed was, you know, we needed enough energy, and then we just were trying to get that 1-2% efficiency. Great. We have that energy. We know core collapse is working because we saw the neutrinos. We have something that's going to convect, and hopefully it can drive an explosion. And in 1994, Marc Courant actually got an explosion. Again, not all the physics done right. So, and over the course of, you know, at this point, almost every group has gotten an explosion at some point. They also still get fizzles. So we're at the point where we're worried about the details. But what can we predict out of this model? Well, one thing you can do is you can say there's an observation that most supernova are around a few times 10 to the 51 ergs. I confirmed this with Luc Desart. Still, the explosions are a few times 10 to the 51 ergs or lower. If you have an engine, you want to be, your engine should be able to get 10 to the 51 ergs of explosion, but it shouldn't, you know, I don't want to be on, for most of my explosions, I don't want to be 10% efficient. I really do want to be just a 1 or 2% efficient. I don't want to be 10%. So somehow, nature has been as mean to us as it can be, and nature is using mean to support theorists. It's either nature or so the observers that's trying to lead us on. But the observation is that we aren't using 10% efficient. And that's throwing away hypernova and gamma ray bursts at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting conclusion. I mean, so this simple argument gives you this very large energy, so you have this low threshold for requiring it. But you could look at it another way and saying that actually the engine is of order, you know, that maybe something that is 10% or 50% efficient wouldn't be, you know, maybe that's telling you the natural scale, not that, you know, two orders of magnitude below the natural scale. So it's, why do you argue that, I mean, you know, why not argue, look, this is, you know, while this is tantalizing, it's the wrong track.
Yeah, so you could say, yeah, you know, this is the wrong engine because
it's like way overkill.
But we know it's right. We know it's right because we saw the neutrinos. So at this point we any other engine you're going to get, you have to get the neutrinos. In fact, we know why it's not, you know, where the energy's going. It's in the neutrinos. Right? So the model actually predicted most of this 10 to the 53 years comes out in neutrinos, and we see it. So we actually, you know, there's not a, you don't want to go out with another model, because that model has to at least match the, you know, A, you know, the first observation, you need the energy. Two, you need the neutrinos. So 87A said there are neutrinos there. That rules out a lot of the bizarre, it ruled out the thermonuclear model for 87A. Right? It can't be. So can we with this engine, what?
That's debated, right?
Whether there's neutrinos?
No, so you know, there's the paper by Bloom and Kushnir, right, talking about the thermonuclear model for 87A and the black hole remnant, right?
I don't know any model that argues that if it's a thermonuclear, it won't make a black hole. So I think they were still saying it was... You could have it be a rapidly rotating star and make it thermonuclear and still get the neutrinos because you rapidly rotate it, let it collapse down to a neutron star. Even the Woolsey model, model of in the 80s of a rapidly rotating star being blowing up out of thermonuclear, you rapidly rotate so much that when it collapses, it forms a disk and doesn't collapse down to a neutron star. It'd be neat to see what the engine is, but I think if you're saying it's slammed to a black hole, it did this core collapse first.
I'm just saying that the, you know, Bloom and Kushnir, the title of their paper is Neutrino Signal of Collapse-Induced Thermonuclear Supernovae, the Case for Prompt Black Hole Formation in 87A. So it's debated.
It's fine. It's a bit... Okay. And then also, we don't have any climate change, right? You can find one theorist to say that.
That's low.
So I don't think that no one else, I mean, if you want to make it a black hole, it collapsed down to a neutron star first. So they definitely had it collapse down to a neutron star. If they wanted to, it's a paper that I think none of the community takes seriously. So and I also don't take seriously the loads of papers that say the Earth is not warming. So I will limit it to those that have at least 100 papers on the idea. Because this has literally thousands of papers of people working on. So here's how you could get the energy. The pressure of this infalling material is 1/2 rho v squared. The pressure of this convective region I can also derive. And I can write down the equation, it gets long. But I can derive this equation for what's the pressure in this convective region. And when that pressure, so I have what happens is I'm heating the material up, it's rising, it's pushing against this boundary. When that pressure gets above this infalling pressure, it's going to move out. So you can ask the question, what's the energy in this convective region when its pressure is above this infall pressure? And then it's a function of time because the density of the star that's falling in changes with time. But I can calculate this pressure, and I can calculate this energy. The energy, the maximum energy I can get from this kind of, if I assume, so once it starts blowing out, I'm not going to deposit any neutrinos. So once it starts moving out, this energy starts to stop. Now, there's ways to get a little bit more energy after I start moving it out. You can have material fall back in and drive more energy. But this gives you a rough idea of the energy I'm going to get is when this pressure over exceeds this pressure. That energy is 1 to 3 foe. So 1 to 3 times 10 to the 51 ergs. So this convective engine naturally explains why most explosions are 1 to 3 foe. Now, what it then does is this convective engine cannot explain hypernova. It cannot explain GRB-associated supernova. This engine cannot make that happen. But it does explain why most supernova are all on the level of a few times 10 to the 51 ergs, because that's as much as it can make. So that is the natural explanation of why I released 10 to the 53 ergs, but then only got a few foe. And so when I was a grad student, this was the question every observer asked, why are you always only 1% efficient? And then we did this, we had this model, we did this calculation and said, oh, that's why. So this is a strength of this model. This is why we start believing it, right? It explains that energy in a way that it's not a prediction because we already knew that most supernovae were that, but it's a fallout of accepting this as the engine. and it came after we actually had accepted it into. So that's
sorry,
that's.
I'm back up, Chris. Yeah. I'm totally lost. No, I'm not totally lost, but I just want to clarify something. So most of this 10 to 53 urge is coming out in neutrinos.
Yeah.
And the engine is some convective process that's happening that has energy 1 to 3 fold. That's it.
So,
am I just like?
But the point is, once I got to 1 to 3 fold, I start to push this off and I turn the engine off, right? So this is.
But the engine is somehow convection.
But this is the thing is, the engine is I have a pot I'm burning below it. I have a lid on this pot. I have a pressure cooker, right? You can calculate. And I asked you to go home and do this. You know the weight of your the strength of your little knobs on your pressure cooker. You can calculate how hot can you get this material in this pressure cooker before it blows off the lid. That is exactly what I'm doing here. I'm saying I have a convective engine. How hot can I go until I blow off the lid, blow off this star? And that is a few times 10 to 51 urge. You cannot get higher. Right? It is impossible to get higher. The pressure cooker blows up, all whatever is in your thing spews out of the pot. Now the pot is no longer, in fact, if it's water in here, you no longer get any hotter.
So why it doesn't blow up before? Is it time scale?
If I have less energy than that, whatever this ramp pressure is, it doesn't explode, right? The pressure has to be greater. How do I get it to explode until my pressure gets greater than this?
In order to explode, you have to exceed that, right?
Yeah, so as soon as I exceed it, I will start exploding. Yeah, as soon as I exceed it, I will start to explode. But that's the constraint. Yeah.
So is it fair to say this 1 to 3 fo is just set by the binding energy of the core of the star? Because that's what's setting rho v squared.
This is its tie to something like the compactness parameter. It really is. I mean, it's really the density profile that matters. The compactness, so it's coming from the structure of the star at collapse. And so the compactness parameter, the reason we like, or the reason it's at all valid is it's getting some estimate of what this is.
But I'm just saying, fo is a very natural energy scale, it's just the binding energy of the original thing. So it's not that surprising that that's the number you get out at the end.
Well, right? Yeah, it's not really the binding energy. In the sense, if you say it's.
That's what's setting the energy scale for all this, for rho v squared.
You could instead say, because the binding energy is what do I need to make it escape? And that's, since this is in fall, is free fall, then it's the same velocity, yeah. So the binding energy, what you need to make it explode is that. So.
And the only reason why
that's what this calculation is, right?
The
so yeah.
The reason why you really have a high explosion is just because you have a high gradient of Fourier. I mean, you have a pressure equalized at the boundary, but
yeah.
You have a big excess inside.
But there's plenty of so the magnetic field explosion model doesn't need this, right? It can get way higher. In fact, we need that to make it to explain gamma. So magnetic field, you can use that. The magnetic field model is not limited by the binding energy of the star. So there's an engine that's not limited by that. It's the magnetic field in here. Magnetar. Neither of those are limited.
Just a numerical question out of curiosity. And this is this 1 to 3 fold range is obtained by a range of different calculations with different schemes. And
so typically the calculations right now are getting less energy than that, and what they're doing is the 1 to 3 is the max. But if I wait long enough, the density goes down, and the binding energy. So you could say the binding energy is going down, and the energy I need is only about 0.4 fo. And so you can actually, in fact, the plot that we ended up doing was what is the explosion energy as a function of time during the explosion, and so this would be the energy. It's the binding energy, and it looks something like this, and then goes down. And so if I wait for 1 second. I only need about 0.2 fo to make the explosion, whereas this peak, so this is around 0.2, this is 1 to 3, and so the max energy I can get is 1 to 3, but I can also make weaker explosions with this if I wait longer. So depending on when these...
When you say here binding energy, isn't it because your PD at a shock place is changing?
Yeah, this is changing. The row is changing.
With time, your shock getting like a further away?
You know, it's just the density of the star that's falling in on it is getting lower. Right, so the density structure of a star is high, but then drops off with radius pretty dramatically. So why does this convection help? The reason the convection helps is two. One is, here's my gain region, and I was telling you when they did 1D models, you would heat down here, and then it would heat up until it started emitting neutrinos. Now what happens is I heat down here, and it rises. So that energy, that heat energy, is not going to get re-emitted in neutrinos. It's going to expand, push up, change that heat energy into kinetic energy pushing up. It's going to cool when it does that. So I can more efficiently take the energy from neutrinos and convert it from heat energy to something that's pushing against this this infalling material. The other thing it does is, in the 1D models, is this material that was falling in on it. In a 1D model, it just piles up, and it keeps on adding pressure. In a multi-D model, that material ends up falling in. So the pressure really is just 1/2 rho v squared. If I allowed the mass to pile up, I'd have a mass that I have to blow off. In this case, that density is going down with time. The mass here that's piling up is going down with time, not going up with time. So it removes some from that lid of that pot, and it allows the energy to not start getting lost through neutrinos because it allows it to expand. So this is where convection has been helpful in that.
This is also telling you something about the asymmetries of the explosion.
So that's the other observations that we... So one is, now we have this thing that actually naturally explains the energies. The alternative way to do this is to say, you know, the alternative model that's now the nearest competitor is something where you generate magnetic fields. So either I put magnetic fields in a magnetar, and then I try to drive the explosion with the magnetar. I form a disk around the neutron star. Now, the issue with the disk around the neutron star is, I just calculated this recently, so you can calculate how much angular momentum do you need to make a disk that's 100 kilometers in size. You know, so I want it centrifugally supported at 100 kilometers. And that angular momentum is around 4×10^16 centimeters squared per second. So specific angular momentum in the material. That is as high as the fastest models that Georges Monnet is producing right now, with no coupling of, you know, with only that minimal coupling. No Hank Spruce dynamo, no mechanism really coupling the core to the outside, so it doesn't spin down. So it's pretty hard to get the, and it would make a 0.5 millisecond pulsar. So it requires really high velocities to make a disk around a neutron star. The mechanism for, the reason that Stan Luzzi argued for black hole accretion disks for the gamma ray burst engine, the collapsar engine, was that he wanted to accrete some of this low angular momentum material. If you look at a star, the angular momentum, specific angular momentum, goes up as you go out in radius. And he wanted to get that faster spinning outer material, so he'd accrete the inner 3 to 5 solar masses of the star, and then that higher angular momentum material on the outside, where their models could predict 10^17 centimeters squared per second, would form a disk and make a jet. So the problem with the disk around a neutron star is just that it's hard to get that kind of fast rotation speeds. It may be hard to get, I mean, in fact, it is hard to get them for the collapsars as well, the ones that form black holes, but it's a little bit easier. The magnetron model, you don't need those kind of high spin periods, but you do need to be able to generate strong magnetic fields and make a magnetar. In that particular case, it would predict a range of energies depending on the spin period. So it doesn't naturally explain why most of them are in the 10^51 erg. It explains a range of energies. I think you're going to have to use these magnetic fields to explain the hypernova that we observe, but you don't, you know, for... You would have to really tune your spin, your rotation periods, and that could be the answer. You have to, the stellar modelers have to find how they get the exact right spin periods to match these observations. With this particular engine, you don't have, that's explained regardless of what the stellar modelers do to us. So this is a particular observation that then the model has explained. Remember, it was driven by observations to get the mixing, and in fact, these asymmetries are one of the big things that you're trying to explain with these supernova is how do I get this induced mixing in this.
Chris, I'm missing some fundamental thing. I'm hoping you can explain to me. If I think back to my pressure cooker,
yeah,
and I think the heat's going up, I think that the lid sort of adjusts. It doesn't all of a sudden blow off. So I'm trying to understand
in a pressure cooker, it doesn't, right? Because it's clicked on.
Well,
so
okay,
once you blow it up, it goes.
If you didn't click it on, it would adjust. It wouldn't just blow
well,
up.
It would, and then stuff would leak out, right? So
yeah,
you just have it leak
yeah,
out.
I don't see the explosives here. So I'm missing a time scale, I think.
So once you start moving this up, because that's what it's doing, it's doing. Suddenly, this pressure goes down. This pressure is not, you know, is really high, and it's just a runaway process. So whenever we see this in the simulations, once I start getting it up, once I start moving, that energy. So I have this energy.
It
starts
to. Changing his weight.
The lid is changing its weight.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe I can understand that.
So
okay.
The sphere is the lid is not a solid thing.
No, I understand that.
It's got weaknesses in it.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. If it has weaknesses, then it would be like the size. So once you get
something going out, in fact, what happens is once you get it going out, you see these bubbles just rising like crazy. There are still some downflows going in, but the energy required to start moving it up, right? If I'm at 10 to the 50 erg here, and it's 10 to the 50 erg I need to push out, it's not moving out. Once I get roughly at that 10 to the 51 erg, so maybe I'm a little bit less, these bubbles start to rise out. Mm-hmm. And then these bubbles have 10 to the 51 ergs in them. So they are carrying away this 10 to the 51 ergs. You'll see this thing expand by 1,000 kilometers. There's some downflow still, but at this point the stuff is moving out, and the energy in that moving out material is 10 to the 51 ergs. Right? I mean, it's... you know, if you want the bubble to, you know, if you want to have these hot bubbles just leak through here, when it's at 10 to the 50 ergs, that's requiring a, it's not hydrodynamically, that would be saying, well, that why does that not happen in stars in the shell burning phases? Why don't you get the entropy, you know, so we know this in
it. So holes in your lid. You put holes in your lid, you make it less efficient. So this is what I'm like.
Okay, so.
No, I mean,
so
you're just saying one bubble
so
that gets out is enough.
I assume you know stellar convection, so let's look at the shell burning stellar convection.
So
why does the bubbles, why don't they rise up? Why don't, you know, I get a little bit of burning in any shell, helium shell, oxygen shell, whatever you want. Why don't they rise through here and just leave? Because they don't. You know, because there's a tension to the material. And this stuff is certainly, you can get bubbles that are high entropy, they just don't rise through this region in the same way they won't do here, until you start getting very close to that energy where you're pushing the lid up. And at that point, you'll get these bubbles rising. So what you end up getting is, you see these hot bubbles rising like this.
Is having the negative entropy gradient is also important here? So
that's what the issue is, no, that is not important because that stuff is falling in. It's actually not in a stable condition at this point. So the material is just falling in, and as it piles up. But it's the same as stellar convection, the same reason you don't get bubbles leaking out in stellar convection. So it's basic hydrodynamics, I guess.
But that's exactly the distinctions. Carrie does it, she gets plumes penetrating and they create waves going up. Why doesn't that?
Oh, you can have gravity waves going up. In fact,
here instead of this massive.
You know, you want gravity waves going up instead. Or
you're losing energy the whole time is the point, right? So how? I mean, somehow you're leaking a bit of energy here and there. Yeah, this thing isn't perfect.
So this, but in
gravity waves, what you lose like less than 1%, right?
But what I'm asking is, how is it happening all of a sudden? Like all of a sudden, you're losing all your energy instead of. A gradual process.
Once you start moving it out, then it because it's 10, once I start moving out, the bubble gets here, the pressure it needs is less, It accelerates until it just...
So it's
unstable, yeah. So once I can start moving out, it just runs away.
Yeah, I don't think the physics is the same as in stellar convection. Stellar convection wants
I never
to go.
Said it was. No.
I'm trying to mark your interest
here.
Yeah.
Once you get out of the convection region, the entropy gradient is no longer negative, and so you no longer are unstable.
Yeah, there's usually a really sharp entropy...
No buoyancy force anymore.
Yeah.
Here, it's not... so much a buoyancy force. It's once you go out, now there's nothing pushing you back in anymore. So you start to expand, but then you lose your energy source. So you don't keep getting forced out here once you go out, because now there's nothing driving you from beneath.
You're practically expanding into a vacuum.
It's like you're just coasting out. Right. See, to me, it's when you say you're coasting out, it just seems to me like, oh, not really an explosion. But I guess, okay.
You could call it a wind.
Yeah.
You could call it a wind. It's just, it's a 10 to 51 wind, yeah.
But there is a shock.
Yeah.
Still.
Okay, so you can also look at what are the remnant masses looking like. And you can say, okay, I get these energies. What happens if I plug these energies in and watch the stars explode, and am I getting the right rough remnant masses? And at the time that we were studying this, remnant masses were bimodal. They were either 1.4 solar masses, or they were, because at the time we mostly just had these binary pulsars, and so if you talk to, about 15 years ago, you talk to a remnant observer, they would tell you, yep. There's a paper by Chakrabarty and Thorsett where they're all at either 1.4 solar masses or they're at 7 to 10, depending on which observer was looking at, for black holes. So they had a bimodal distribution of remnants. At the time, this engine, it was very hard to... You should have some random part of material falling back, so we did some calculations of just, if I take these energies and see what the binding energies of the stars are, what kind of remnant masses, and we predicted a range of masses. So we predicted that there should be a range of neutron star masses all the way up to the top of the neutron star mass, and then black hole masses as well. And at that point, this was actually, every time engine theorists would publish a paper, the remnant observers would say, but that's not what the data says. Then we just started discovering neutron star masses that were 1.7, 2.0 solar masses, 1.2. So we started to get a range of neutron star masses. There's still this gap in the remnants between, depending on how much you think you can accrete onto the remnant from a companion, there's a gap between about 2 to 4 solar masses. We don't see any remnants in that region. And that was not predicted by the engine. In fact, what it does is place a constraint on how the engine must work, how much fallback we do get. But the idea that there should be a range of masses was actually something that this engine was also arguing that you should see. And if you look at the comparisons to kind of what we can do for engines now and what we get out of the remnant masses, we're starting to get a range that is fairly reasonable to compared to what the observations are. So it's not, you know, the prediction was there should be a range of masses. We now see those range of masses, but the range predicted by the model was not exactly what we're seeing, because the model did not predict the gap, and it looks like the gap is real. And with that case, you have to then place constraints on the engine. But so remnants were something that I would say they at least partially predicted this engine. The last was these asymmetries. So this model. This model now has these convection lobes. When it drives an explosion, whatever low mode you're at is what you get for the explosion going out. So in the extreme case, and we see this especially in the standing accretion shock models, they're sloshing back and forth, and when you explode, you actually explode in one direction only. When you do these in 3D, it starts to get not so low mode, a little bit higher mode, and you see, you know, maybe 3 or 4 big bubbles. When Marc Courant was first studying this in 94, in 95 he said, look, this convection is going to go to low mode. And he was arguing it would explain kicks. So we're trying to explain neutron star kicks. We wanted to explain things like polarization in supernova. So if you rotate this model, it can damp out the convection in this region, limiting the convection to the polar region. This is just because there's now an angular momentum gradient that's stabilizing against convection. So the convection is primarily in the polar axis, and that drives that drives a bimodal explosion. So we did a whole series of bimodal explosions from these. But if it's not rotating that rapidly, you expect lobes going out like this in some motion. How do you check this? Well, titanium is produced in the same place as the nickel, down in this inner region. And titanium has a half-life of about 60 years. So you could go look at a supernova remnant and say, where's the titanium? And it turns out you can only look at one supernova remnant that's close enough with that the New Star satellite can look at it. And so they did this. They said, this model predicts that we should see bubbles rising out. We should see these bubbles rising out. They should be titanium. We should see some titanium bubbles. So they went and looked with New Star at Cass A. And this was a couple years ago. The paper is Greffin said it all. And you see titanium bubbles rising out. And in fact, you see the momentum of the titanium is exactly the opposite as the kick of the compact remnant, the CCO that's in that object. And at this point, there is, you know, that this was a prediction of the convective engine. No other engine had this prediction. In fact, the other engines were focusing on a jet. No other engine had this prediction. And that particular observation, I don't know how else to explain it, but with this kind of convective engine. And at that point, that's what sealed this engine as the favorite engine. And it's at this point, it's really hard to get around that kind of strong prediction in the engine. So I didn't bring the plot of Cass A, but go look at New Star Cass A, and you'll see that the choosy colored in cyan, the cyan colored titanium distribution, and you see these bubbles. So it's an exact signature of this convective engine.
Why would it come out from a jet engine?
So if you did a jet, the titanium would look like, so if I did a jet, the titanium would look like this. So any bimodal explosion, the titanium would look like this. And it looks like, and it looks something like this.
It's just blobby.
So at this point, there's no argument that, you know, so really, honest to God, there is no, you know, it's really, there is no other model that predicts that kind of shape. So there's nothing on the table that can predict. So for at least for Cass A, this convective engine is the only one on the table. Now, it could be that you also add a jet later, but the issue is for Cass A at the moment, there's almost no, there's no other way to explain. So I just got out of the Cass A meeting at Princeton. All of the people talking about engines were showing how, I can get the titanium production. You know, here's my model that fits the data. Now, the issue is, I think there's more to the data than that. We can learn about these explosions because the titanium to nickel ratio will tell us something about exactly this energetics. But the basic morphology came out of this engine, and now we're at the point of, now let's take that detailed data and say what exactly, how big were these lobes? You know, how hot were they? So we can start probing that with the Cass A. But we're at the point of, we know it had to have these bubbles going out, and now we're using the data to understand the features of those bubbles. But we're not, you know, that's where the community's on for Cass A right now, is how do we study the features of those bubbles.
So what explains the there are a lot of these 3D simulations now, and a lot of them don't get supernova, right? So what's the distinction?
So the problem at this point is the supernova, the simulations themselves are not quantitatively predictive, and it looks like nature hates us in that there's a cliff there where it's not that you either get a strong explosion, or if you can't drive this out at all, it starts to move in. And if it starts to move in, it gets harder and harder to make it explode, and you can have it just move all the way in and make a black hole.
It's because you lose more and more with nature,
yes? If this starts moving in, this pressure, the V is going up, because it's the infall velocity, and so it's harder and harder to make it explode, and if you can't get enough energy soon enough, this stuff will just, the ram pressure will just end up making you accrete, or if you can't drive an explosion within a second, the material falling in, accreting onto the proto-neutron star, will push it above the maximum neutron star mass, and it'll collapse down to a black hole. So if you can't get it to happen quickly, or this starts to move in, you cannot make this thing will fail, and you'll make a black hole. And the problem we're having right now is I change my resolution. I changed my, so there was a series of papers by Thomas Janka where he did a wedge, didn't get an explosion, said I must be missing some physics, opened up to 180 degrees and suddenly got explosions. So it was just the numerics between getting, so there's numerical issues that, so I didn't say we could take a 15 solar mass star and this is what its explosion looks like. We're not at that level because it's numerics, it's how well we resolve the convection. How well did we do the initial seeds? How well did we do the neutrino physics? So what Adam Burroughs is finding with his group right now is that if he does more advanced neutrino physics, it makes it a little bit easier to explode. So he gets it easier to explode if he does more advanced neutrino physics. But it's now at the details of those, whether or not you get an explosion or not. I think that's a reasonable thing for what nature is doing because, and that would be another observational argument, is you need to be able to sometimes make black holes and sometimes make neutron stars. And the cores don't look all that different. So if you look at the compactness parameter, it may look quite a bit different. But if you look at the entropy profile, it gives you a better idea of what the density profile is. It's not so different than that you should say, oh, this is going to, you know, it's easy to say whether one thing explodes or not. In fact, Adam Burroughs was arguing at the Princeton meeting that the higher the compactness parameter, the easier for him it is to explode right now. So he argues that the trend is not true. I think that's just an artifact of his current simulations. But it may be true. It may be that it's actually, because there's a lot of different physics going into how do I get energy into this region.
So rotation is in or not in these models, and how? Can you make like a figure over there, some plots of like what things or lists, what things are really killing us and not killing us? You know,
so,
what things are so affecting us?
I mean, the problem is that it's affecting every. So there was a long time where general relativity was the big thing that people were missing. It softened the equation of state, changed the bounds. Hans Bethe and it was Bethe, Brown, I think, were arguing this. I'm trying to get the other names on that. But that was one that people, and we usually include some simplification for general relativity. Do we need to have it full up general relativity? That's one question. There's the neutrino physics that can change the answer. This is things as simple as the way we include neutrino, anti-neutrino annihilation. Is approximate. If they have any role in the energy, they can do it. So it's, you know, things like asymmetric scattering kernels can make a difference. So this is what Adam started to add, more detailed scattering kernels to his neutrino physics. The neutrino physics generally that we were using initially assumed it was a low density limit for neutrinos, so there weren't that many nucleon interactions. So you didn't have three-body neutrino emission. If you add the three-body neutrino emission, this is, I think, Adam's argument, you add some of the three-body effects, it's enough to change the neutrino fluxes. In the most extreme case, there's neutrino oscillations that can play a role. This is what George Fuller pushes. All of these, so you know, three-body interactions, all this kind of neutrino physics can make a difference. They're typically 10% effects. But the problem is that 10% effect in a kind of cliff scenario can make the difference between an explosion and not an explosion. There's neutrino transport, so there's also the numeric, so that's physics, but there's neutrino transport, there's hydro, are we resolving, so the numerical issues are we resolving the hydrodynamics? The neutrino transport is, are we actually accurately calculating the neutrino species? If you just do flux limit diffusion, you are assuming, or you're making assumptions on the neutrino where it's going, where the neutrinos are going, and how they're being deposited. If you do the ray by ray stuff that Thomas Janka pushed, you're only putting doing neutrino transport along some rays. So rotation, other physics is rotation. You can put this in. There's a lot of models with rotation, but without magnetic fields, so I'll put magnetic fields as well. All of these things can change the physics for getting a quantitative answer. If the rotation of the star is fast, if I grab, say, one of these fast-rotating Hager models from, you know, either no split dynamo model or a weak split dynamo model, I can get enough rotation to change where the convection is. if it's rotating a little bit faster, I form a, you know, if I can get a really fast one, I can form a disk that can have a dynamo that produces strong magnetic fields. So that can play a role in the explosion. For normal, for like the best rotating stars now, it will affect the hydrodynamic sum, but it's, you're not going to get that many windings in your dynamo. You just don't form a disk around the neutron star, so you can't. It's harder to make those strong magnetic fields. But there certainly are, you know, people looking at forming those disks around these protoneutron stars and driving the explosions just from that. But it does require higher rotation rates than are typically produced in models now. What are other?
Can I ask? Okay, so
equation of state physics is the other one.
So this is all the things that are in the codes that are causing there to be a one or not. So let's say we think for sure there's GR, and you know the physics of the oscillations, et cetera, et cetera. What in nature do you think is picking out the ones that are going off and not?
So in the end, if we did it all right, then it is the structure of the star that's making the difference between success and failure. It's the rotation rate, and the density profile of the star that's deciding whether it succeeds or fails. And there are slight differences from the star. The argument we have right now is something like, you know, we had papers saying above 20 solar masses, it's going to get harder and harder to make these things explode. Aside from some, you know, there's some variations in the stellar evolution models, but there was a general trend that the compactness parameter at the time that we were first looking at this, it was just the entropy and the density profile, was such that it got harder to explode when the density went up. So it's that pressure being higher that made it harder to explode. And that was the argument. So, you know, we had essentially an argument back in the late 90s, early 2000s, that, you know, above about 20 solar masses, most stars would fail. And we still believe that today. If you look at, you know, we now have at the time, again, the light curve model said that, Hamane's thesis said that the all supernovae have ejecta masses of above 20 solar masses. And that was very anti what the theory was saying, the engine theory was saying. So we actually ignored that data and just went happily along. Turns out that data was wrong, and we now have observations of about 10, a little bit more progenitors before collapse, and they're all less than 20 solar masses. So it looks like supernova R, it's below 20 solar masses, we're getting explosions. Above 20 solar masses, there's still, the sampling is not good enough to say none explode above 20 solar masses. But above 20 solar masses, it's harder to get explosions. That's probably the feature. It's that slight change in structure that then makes it either easier or harder to make an explosion happen. And so I think that's the trend of where things are going. But we don't have, none of this physics is done well by, you know, there are parts where someone says, I'm going to focus on this physics and do a good model. But no one puts all this physics in a way that's defensible. And has that perfect model yet. So we're not at that perfect model. We're definitely not close to resolving the hydrodynamics. The neutrino transport, I think we're on the verge of getting neutrino transport that I think is fairly reliable. There's people doing Monte Carlo now. There's multi-D discrete ordinate methods being used. I think we're at the point where they're not yet in prime time where we can do 3D models with them. But we're getting to a point that I think that's going to happen before Bill and I kick the bucket.
So pretty generically, when you do get an explosion, you get a weak exploder, right?
Generically, the simulations are getting, they're exploding too late. So they're exploding yet.
That was what I was going to say. So what you really want is the growth of the engine timescale to somehow be shorter, generically shorter. You want to explode things when it's harder to explode them, right?
Yeah, we want to explode them sooner. And so there's easy ways to make that. One is, if I did the seeds more correctly, this is why Sean Couch was looking at the seeds. If I do the seeds more correctly, I start with something that already has strong seeds at bounce. And those convective seeds then grow, so you can get it growing faster. So you either want to grow the convections faster.
But
Isn't that like a bit in contrast with the statement that the stellar structure will decide what explodes and what not? Because the same 15-star mass model could have different seeds.
So that is the thing. So it's the stellar structure. When I say stellar structure, that includes those seeds.
That's
okay. So it's the stellar monomers in the end are going to dictate what the seeds are, what the magnetic field that collapses, because that will change how important MHD might depend on what your initial magnetic fields collapsing are, what the rotation is. All of that is determined by the stellar structure. Yeah.
So if you think the seed is a big effect, I'm not sure if someone's done this, but could you just start off different explosion simulations with seeds of different sizes and what do I need? Do I need something that's completely unrealistic in order to get something right?
So Sean Couch has done some studies on this. We are actually in the process of doing exactly that, where we're putting in different levels of seeds to do exactly the study that you're talking about. And in the end, all groups are looking at doing exactly that to see what kind of seeds do they need. But the issue is, there's so many other uncertainties that the seed I need depends. We've had low seeds produce explosions with a chosen set of neutrino physics and all this other stuff. So it's not, if it were one thing only, then you could place a limit on what kind of seed you need. But it's not that. It's all this physics put together. It's why it's hard to get a quantitative answer.
But as I think was mentioned, I think it's telling that it sounds like generically you're always getting too low energies, so...
Generically your seeds are off?
Yeah.
Well, so it could be generically your seeds are off, and I do... So if you're asking me, I think that's it, right? I think I see it. I think it's both a combination of the seeds are off, and we don't have the resolution.
Can you tell me exactly where the seeds... Is it velocity fluctuation?
It's density and velocity fluctuations in the silicon shell burning. Okay. So we even have a handle on this. We take the multi-D models by Dave Arnett, or in the case of Sean Couch, he did the models himself and let them collapse. But you can look at either density or velocity perturbations and let that collapse and see what happens.
1D models?
What?
1D.
No, we're taking the 3D models from... Well, so what we typically do is we take the 3D models from our net, and that gives us an idea of what the magnitude of those seeds are. We put those seeds in our collapse calculation, our 3D collapse calculation, and see how it grows. What Sean Couch did is one step better, which is he actually took the star near collapse, modeled it in 3D until it did collapse, and then followed it through collapse. So you could, either way you can do that. You can add those seeds.
So where he sits, which is like bigger than usually what you use?
What?
The seeds.
They were on par. They were because it's not, not surprising. He didn't get a result that was way different than what Arnett had. But the issue is, even when we do that, we're not getting the growth time right, and that's almost certainly because we're not resolving the hydro. So,
Given that you haven't quite solved all of the problems in the world, what about those of us who are sort of interested after the first second? What can we do in terms of, say, simulating core collapse supernova after the first second while the shock is moving
out? So you have the shock.
Can we do realistic things there to learn some more just by assuming certain properties of what happens at 1 second?
And I talked a little bit about remnants. So that we do a lot of those studies where we drive the explosion and we look at the fallback, and that's how we got our remnant masses. There's a couple different ways to get fallback. We can study that physics. The supernova, the ejecta remnants. The whole meeting on Cas A was looking at the ejecta from it. And you, as the shock moves out, it produces nucleosynthetic yields. You then try to match it to what you see. And that was that observation that really told us something. It was the titanium distribution that really said you have to have something like this. But it was, and so there's a lot of work going into that. There's then in the light curves and stuff, you can start, again, all this was constrained by things like the gamma rays getting out early. So you can look at that mixing. You can look at,
I'm trying to get at slightly different things in terms of answering questions like, how far out did the nickel get sent out by these initial plumes versus how much mixing happens later on by later stages of Rayleigh-Taylor after the shock reaches the base of the helium.
So the worst part about this is when you're looking at a remnant and you see all these instabilities, you have instabilities from the explosion. You have instabilities that were seeded in the shell burning that then the shock is going through. And so that's another set of instabilities that will drive drive further Rayleigh-Taylor or Rickmeyer-Meshkov, depending on the conditions. Then when this goes out into the circumstellar medium, in a lot of cases, the circumstellar medium is already asymmetric. And so I have to worry about the asymmetries there and that the shock is moving through. And even if it isn't asymmetric, there's still going to be Rayleigh-Taylor. But if there is asymmetries, that can focus. John Blondin and Roger Chevalier produced these jet-like structures from just going through the circumstellar medium. And in fact, the reason that we like the titanium as a constraint is it is so what happens is that shock goes through the circumstellar medium, sends a reverse shock through. What we mostly see in remnants is the stuff lit up by either the shock or the reverse shock. So you see that region. The material inward of that has not been affected by the circumstellar medium yet, and a lot of the titanium was in there. So I know the asymmetries I'm seeing in the titanium are not from some weird circumstellar medium. The rest of it, I have to worry about that circumstellar medium and what did it do to the light. So all of those require some study. Remnants are on the harder side because you're no longer in equilibrium, so you have to worry about non-equilibrium physics. Cosmic rays are being produced, you have to put in that physics. So there's a lot more physics to get to that those observations. So there's
you
a lot of
that trying to model H7A, Stanley Company had to make a lot farther.
Yeah.
Do we have any handle? Is that completely ad hoc still, or do we have intuition from these models about where that niggle is?
So remember, that's why we had this asymmetry explosion in the first place. 87A looks like it was strongest in one direction. So it did get down to this very low mode where you had in one direction it's very strong, it's weaker in the other. Part of the reason we know this is if you look at the nickel, I talked about broad lines, but it actually was broad in the redward way mostly. So it's the explosion was going off away from me. So if we're the observers, the explosion is going off in this direction and we're seeing that redshift of those lines. And so that one was very low mode, where the dominant explosion was in one direction. And so we're using, that means that you do have to get a range of, CAS A is a little higher mode than 87A, we think. But those are the two that we have, good, in fact, the 87A is not as strong as a result, but because it has an extreme one low mode going in one direction, it looks like that one's, we see that in the explosion. So we can look at that and say, can we get the nickel mixing out? There we can, if it's low mode like it is, we do get the nickel mixed out in that. We did a whole, this is actually Amy Hungerford's thesis, was looking at exactly trying to match that data. So these are kinds of pieces of data that we've tried to explain. And so that's, that's kind of the game we're playing right now.
Why isn't the crab remnant as useful for this stuff?
Well, because the crab itself shapes a lot of the structure on the inside. So you don't see, the crab is affecting the structure there. And most remnants, the problem is that they're not close enough that we can image them with New Star. So it'll take a next generation hard X-ray telescope to start looking at titanium. And they have to also be young, because 60 years is good. 300 years, you've only done 5 half-lives. But you're starting, you don't want it to go much older, so you're looking for young remnants that you can resolve. So there just isn't that much you can do for the titanium.
So we're approaching the time limit, but I will abuse my power and ask a question. So what's the difference for engines for GRBs?
For GRBs, the main engines that are being proposed now are magnetic-driven engines. Again, this engine, because of its energy limit, really can't explain them. So it has to be something else. And so the engines are, you have a rapidly rotating star, and it collapses down to a black hole and forms an accretion disk around it. You generate magnetic fields in the disk. It drives a jet. That's an engine. That's the collapsar engine. You can also argue that I can do that with a neutron star and get a disk. That requires more rotation because you need to get a disk around the neutron star where the angular momentum is typically lower. In both these cases...
I don't think the magnetar modeling is a disk.
I wasn't saying magnetar. That's still an accretion disk. The other is to say you have a magnetar where you generate a strong magnetic field in the neutron star, and it's a spinning neutron star. And so there's kind of three engines there that are being proposed. Typically, the magnetar model for GRBs has most favor in the neutron star merger scenario. There you know you're making a nice rapidly rotating neutron star. At least initially it's a neutron star. It may collapse down to a black hole depending on the mass of the neutron stars. I think at this point the favored model for the long duration burst is still the collapsar model. But you know, and then there's the big discussion on gamma ray bursts is what are the progenitors? So the nice thing with short duration bursts is there's strong evidence that it's either neutron star, or neutron star black hole mergers. For the long duration burst, it's a star collapsing, but the question is, how did you make that star collapsing? How did you get it the rotation that it is? So there's lots of binary scenarios for how do you get the strong rotation in those stars. Neutron star mergers, I don't need to worry about rotation, it's there. For the massive stars, I need some way to make fast spinning black holes. And then the question is there a scenario in between where I have, you know, more normal supernova that are spinning rapidly enough to also have a jet associated with them? It's been proposed for the superluminous supernova, although Luc Desart gave us, argued fairly strongly that he can explain them all just by shock interactions. But it's been proposed there for superluminous supernova. There will be some observations where I think you need to have some more than just what the convective engine can explain. But with the data we have now, it's hard to see. So I think those are the main models. There's lots of other scenarios for you can have a white dwarf collapsing to a neutron star. You can get lots of things that make transients. The question is, which of those produce the dominant, most of these observations that we're seeing? I think all of the models that have been proposed, if they're physically, if there's nothing wrong physically with them, nature is pretty good at producing those things that are not forbidden. So this is a T.H. White quote that Kip Thorne at least used for Thorne-Zinkhoff objects. That which is not strictly forbidden is mandatory. So nature will produce anything that physics doesn't prohibit and forbid. And so a lot of these models that people come, if the physics doesn't forbid them, they will exist. The question is, how common are they? Are they 1% of all superluminous supernova? So are magnetars 1% of all superluminous supernova, or are they 95%? I think those are things that you can argue on. Cas A could be weird. It's probably the convective engine, but maybe it's the oddball out. Maybe only because it is weird for other reasons. It may be that all other supernova are not this convective engine, but Cas A, it's pretty hard to argue against it.
Okay, let's thank Chris.